Anyway, hi y'all. I thought I'd learn some Texas before we got here. Oh, I am Marty, an alcoholic, and I'm just so very, very pleased to be here and to be able to introduce three wonderful speakers. The theme of this session is finding your higher power. And I think if you look behind you and look in front of you and look to your left and look to your right, you'll find your higher power. Yeah. It's all of us. It's all of us. It's the glue that holds us together. You wouldn't believe the paperwork involved with being a chairperson nowadays. Okay. May we begin with a moment of silence and use it as you're accustomed to using it. I need to qualify a little bit about myself. As I said, I am Marty, and I'm an alcoholic, and I was born on the wrong side of the invisible line because I've never had a social drink in my life. I don't have a clue even what happens. Maybe it relaxes them and they dawdle around with it all day, or they leave all afternoon or evening and they leave a little of it. Please. Oh, that was not what it was about for me. Anyway, I am from Boston, and I've lived there, yes. South Boston, down near the beach, you know. 75% of us are in the program, and the other 25 are knocking on the door. And anyway, I have come to Boston by way of born in Pittsburgh. Yes, yes, yes. And some years in Ohio. Anyway, I'm 75 years old, and I am the same age as this program, and you can't believe how proud I am of that. Yes. I was born in February of 35, just a few months before Bill met Bob, and they got together. What was it, Mother's Day of 35?
Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway, I am. Where do you think I did my first drinking? You want to take a guess? Akron. The most honky-tonk bars I could find. You know, they say the world was made in 6 days and the Lord rested on the seventh. The part of Akron that I drank in had to be a late Saturday night job. Yeah, yeah, it was one of those. It was incredible. It was jukebox blaring, which I loved. It was people fighting. There was a little TV then, little tiny TV. I'm talking middle 50s. Whoa. Yeah. Middle 50s, and people from all kinds. I loved it, and that's the kind of places I wanted to drink, as honky-tonk and as it could be, and I loved the jukebox I played music to slit your wrists by. I was never a happy drunk. Maybe a lot of you can say the same. I was drinking to take the pain away, and I got here finally. Thank God they started this in 1935, because by the time I was 31, I was here, a has-been that had never been, and I was suicidal, and I was ready to throw it up. And here I am at this age with more sense of joy of living than I ever had in those years. And I'm so glad that we have carried the message that the people are coming in younger. They don't have to lose their 20s and their teens. And I am just so pleased about that. I just want to say, Willie Nelson, there was a quote in the paper the other day. You know, I'd run off with Willie in a New York minute. Oh, look. Jeez. Anybody that could write crazy, okay, yeah. Anyway, he said, and I think this is brilliant, he said, a good country and western is three chords and the truth. Good, huh? Good. And you know what a good AA meeting is? It's God, two alcoholics, and a big book. And we've got it. Well, I am getting pretty close to, in a month or so, 42 years of sobriety. And I'm still crazy after all these years, you know. I would like at this point to begin to introduce my wonderful speakers. And I'm just so much looking forward to this meeting, and I am going to begin with Diane R. from Ontario, Canada.
Yeah.
Hi, everyone. My name's Diane, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi,
I come from a little group in Sudbury, Ontario, Canada. It's called the Lunch Bunch Group, and there's about four of us old ladies and one young guy, and he's not available very often, but when he is, he sets up the tables, and he helps us out really well. On September the 20th, 1985, my brother Harry committed suicide. And he killed his girlfriend. And we had a terrible funeral to go to. And during his funeral, my brother-in-law, who was in the AA program, had only had about 5 years sobriety. And I was in Al-Anon. And I told him, I said, I'll stay sober with you. Because everybody in my family, if they weren't drinking, they were drugging, they were taking pills. And they were doing something other than staying sober and grieving properly. So I stayed sober with him. And as it turned out, I never had to take another drink. Because I decided soon after that my brother's death was not going to be for nothing. My brother Harry is with me today. And on September the 10th, 1985, I took my last drink. And I am very, very proud to be a Canadian woman, a Canadian Aboriginal woman. And my Indian name is Assiniboine, and that means stone woman. And I've always liked rocks, and I collect them. I got them all over my house. I came from a family that was rather tumultuous, very dysfunctional. There was every kind of abuse in our family as I was growing up, and every male person that I trusted didn't do nice things to me. It wasn't all physical. Some of it was through eye contact. Some of it was touching. Some of it was through saying inappropriate things. So I grew up believing that I was bad. I was a bad girl. And I wasn't very happy. And I always was searching to be a good girl because in my heart I knew I wanted to be a good girl. I really did. And I guess at that time my family of origin was my higher power. So in order to be acceptable, I tried to do things for my mom and make her happy. And I tried to enjoy myself with the other kids and in my family. We had another bunch of cousins that we lived close to, and we were all like brothers and sisters. And I realize now that at a very, very young age, I was doing very inappropriate things with my cousin, my boy cousin, and that was all because of my past history. I don't dwell on that much today because those are the things that took me to where I am today. In my teenage years, I guess my higher power might have been, like I loved to go to church, I loved to go to Mass and Communion, and I really enjoyed having friends. I had some good close friends, and I always wanted to be one of the cool people, but I never was, because I never felt like I measured up to anybody. I never felt that I was thin enough, or I had good enough clothes, or pretty enough or anything. I didn't feel I was smart enough, that's for sure. And I barely got by through high school. And at the end of high school, I married the first man that said that he loved me. And I remember one of our first dates, we were invited to a wedding that he went to. He knew the guy. And the first thing he does before we leave is gets into a fist fight. Now, this man that I had started dating was a Polish person from out west in Canada, and this was a French wedding. He understood nothing of French, and he was right in the thick of things, fisticuffs on the floor with somebody else, and I thought, oh, my God. But to me, that was normal. My growing up family, there was a lot of parties. There was There was violence, there was chairs broken and fists in walls and things like that. And I guess when I decided to marry that man that he would protect me, and he became my higher power. I couldn't live, breathe, think, or do anything without him. When he would go away with his buddies to go and hunting or go party or something, I was sick until he came back. I couldn't stand being by myself. We had four children, and I raised those kids, and they were very, very important to me, but they weren't as important as he was. So I spent my years chasing him around. I was abused. I was hit. I was not given money when I needed money for things. And consequently, it reinforced my feelings of low self-worth. And about the 16th year of our marriage, I was huge. I was huge. My comfort was food. It still is somewhat. And I decided I was going to go and have this operation to reduce my weight. And I guess he decided that I wasn't fun anymore because I had quit drinking 3 months before that. And he was still hanging out with his biker buddies and going to strip clubs and hurting my feelings. And, you know, I didn't know what to do. I was in Al-Anon and I wanted him to get sober. I wanted him to go to treatment. And he kept asking me, what is it you want me to do? And I said, you know what you have to do. Because he did have a short time in this program. He just chose not to stay in it. So at the end of those 16 years, he decided to leave. And I was 3 months sober at the time with four kids. I was on welfare. I had a beat up old car. I had a high school education and that was it. And I had four kids to raise. I was sad. I was lonely. And I was bound and bent that I was going to get another boyfriend because he had been the only man that was ever in my life. And I thought, well, if it's good for the goose, it's good for the gander, too. So away I went on my little career of all the relationships I had, and they were all when I was sober. And I managed to raise my children, although doing that, my children were number one. I looked after them well. I always had food. I kept them in a private school. It was very difficult, and sometimes I had to go and ask the nuns at that school if they could help me buy a uniform for my daughter. I had three daughters and a son. One of the things that I instilled in them was pride. And we went to a lot of AA functions. We went to a lot of dances that were sober, and we had fun. And I enjoyed being with my kids. And although I was carrying on this other life with all these different men, I was still looking for love. Love in all the wrong places. And it was really difficult for me because I never felt like I measured up. I never, ever felt that way. And I remember one of my sponsors telling me, that emptiness that you have inside, you have to fill that up with God. And I thought, how the heck do you do that? I don't know how to do that. And I kept going to meetings, and I kept listening, and I kept trying to grasp little tidbits here and there. And another thing one of my other sponsors told me was trust the process. I have done some very, very scary things in my life as a single woman. I remember one time that my poor children were so embarrassed. I used to buy groceries and bounce checks all over our town. And I'd make sure that I didn't go to the same grocery store where I already had a check bounced. But I went to this one store by mistake, and I had gotten a whole bunch of groceries. And I thought, well, I'll pay it back later. And so I write my check. The kids got the groceries in the trunk of the car. And the manager comes over to the cash, and I'm like ready to drop dead on the spot. I said, is there a problem? Of course there was a problem. He said, yes. He said, your check didn't clear, and I'm sorry that we can't let you have those groceries. So they went outside, and they took the groceries out of our car. And my two daughters were very, very embarrassed, and I felt You know, I felt embarrassed for a moment, and then I thought to myself, no, this is a good lesson for me. And I got in the car with the kids, and I said, you know what, guys? I said, this is okay. This is not a bad thing. They did what they had to do, and that's okay. And we'll make it somehow. We'll make it through. I don't for the life of me know how I managed to raise four children on welfare. I don't for the life of me know how I managed to pay for my car repairs, except other AA members helped me with that, for my car insurance, and I went to the Lions Club for grocery money and stuff like that, and that's what I had to do. But I continued to trust in the process, and I continued to come to AA. And I continued to believe that what I had in my heart was good, it was honest, and I was going to get somewhere in my life. When my second daughter decided she was going to go to college, I had an opportunity through the welfare program to go to college as well, and I did that. And I did very well. I was an A student. And then I had an opportunity to go on to become a Native counselor in college. I did a two-year course in college, and I was in college with my second daughter, and it was so cool. And I thank God for those opportunities that allowed me to show my kids that, you know, even though I was an alcoholic, I made lots of mistakes, and I had all these men in my life from time to time, they were never bothered, they were never touched, they were never harmed by anyone. And I always had their back, and they know that today. My children are all left home now, and my first husband is gone and dead. We made peace with each other before he died, and I was with him when he took his last breath. And I forgave him for the things that he did. And I still carry him in my heart. But about 8 years ago, my daughter put me on a site on the internet, and I met my second husband, who turned out to be my high school sweetheart. It was the first kiss I ever had in high school, and I remembered that kiss for 35 years. I never forgot it. He's a wonderful man, and he's very good to me, and I'm very good to him. But we have trouble when we drive around in the car, because especially since he just got this new GPS that wants to take us through the hills and the back roads and the slums of every city that we go near. And I said, if that Samantha's going to be with us on our trip home, she's going right out the window. I don't want to hear that bitch say one thing on the way home. Today, my higher power is meeting someone at the soup kitchen, like I did a couple weeks ago. And I seen this mother and her little baby and her husband taking a wagon away from the soup kitchen in Sudbury. And I had some food that I was going to give to the soup kitchen, but I always scout around to give it to somebody that might need it. And I gave it to her, and she said, thank you very much. I said, do you need some socks? Because I have some socks, too, that I bought. They don't fit my brother-in-law. So I gave her the socks. Thank you so much. Do you want a purse? I said, I got a purse that I was going to give to the mission, too. She said, sure. And then I go into my little change thing. I had no cash on me because it was just getting prepared to come down here. And I said, do you need some money? I said, I give her some change. It was about $3 or $4. And she said, thank you so much. She said, you don't know what that means to me. I said, could you use $50? Oh, my God, she said, could we ever? This is the best time. It couldn't have been at a more right time. I said, follow me to the bank, and away we go. So I went to the bank, and I went in there, and I said, okay, what am I going to give her? $100? Am I going to give her two? Am I going to give her, what am I going to give her? I didn't know. So I went in the bank, and I took $300 out, and I put $200 aside. And I saw her, and she was on the street. They were looking around for me. And I said, here I am, come on over. And I said, here's some money for you. I said, here's $200. And I said, just don't buy any booze or any drugs with it. And I said, you take that with my love, with my respect. And I said, I've been where you've been. I said, I know what it feels like to be on welfare and to be have a hard time. And I said, I love you, and I wish you the best, and God bless you. And she cried, and I cried. To me, the feeling that I had at that time, I could never have bought that with anything. And we sat down when we came to San Antonio. We sat down with this guy on the sidewalk. He looked kind of rough, and he was making stuff with palms. And he made us a rose, and he made us a cross. And we talked to him, and he talked about God and about beautiful things. We never know when we're talking to a stranger. I never know, and I always keep my options open to talk to people that are kind of a little bit different. To show kindness, to open a door, to ask some older person if they might need some help or if they would like a drink of water, that kind of thing. That's where I find my higher power. I love my life today. I know God hasn't taken me here to drop me off and leave me with nothing to work with. Shortly before we came down here, my brother-in-law got into a near-fatal bike accident. And he is surviving, but I believe he has brain damage. And I had my sister and all her friends and everybody in our house like crazy and 1,000 phone calls. My stepson is struggling with his bottom right now, and we have talked to him several times and his girlfriend about the abuse and about the things that he's putting her through and putting himself through. And he talks about suicide. And we tell him the answers are here. And last night when we were at the big meeting last night, my husband and I, at a certain point, I said, oh, my God, I'm thinking of Stefan. He said, so am I. And we often have those thoughts together. We really do. And also my husband was diagnosed with cancer last week. I don't know what's ahead of us. I don't know what's going to happen. But I do know that I trust the process. We'll get through this. And I have his back. And I want to thank everybody for being here. And I just wanted to leave you with one little note, if I don't screw it up. When everything I know in the darkness is gone and I step forward, one of two things will happen. Either I'll step on solid ground or I'll sprout wings and I'll fly. God bless you all and thank you.
You know, when I was drinking in those honky-tonk bars, playing that music to slit your wrists by, Born to Lose, oh, I love them. And I Can't Stop Loving You, oh. But, you know, the music in those days still had some lyrics, okay? I have a friend sitting here in the front row that... when you call her Sal, you're getting Frank Sinatra. Oh, please, it's just beautiful. I don't want to talk to her. I just want to hear Frank Sinatra. You know, we've been given a plan here. We have been given those 12 steps. I've just finished up chemotherapy myself. And as many of you know who have been through this, it's worse than the cancer, the chemo. Okay. And you know, all through that time, Dragon, I thought about you. I thought about being with you. And that's one of the reasons being here today just means so very, very much to me. But anyway, you know, those 12 steps are in a string, and they're in an order. Each one leads to the following one. It's just all one string. And it's just, we admitted we were powerless over alcohol. Here we are. We came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. And you know, when I got that, my first sober 24 hours. Because I had been drinking for 14 or 15 years to the point of drunkenness every day of my life. And to have gotten 24 hours of sobriety was just, you didn't need to convince me that there was a higher power, because I couldn't do it myself. Then we turn this bag of troubles that we are over to a power greater than ourselves. I have trouble with that one. I have to do that 5 or 6 times a day. Anybody else have to work on that? When I find out I can't get around it or under it or over it and I'm going to have to give that up, then I do it. And I do it. And then we look at ourselves in that fourth step, and that's a tough one. You know, I've taken several fourth steps over the years. And I found that with the first one, I got a sense of patterns. Patterns of my behavior. And every time I get in a jackpot, and you will get into them even in sobriety, do another four step. Then run like the devil and try to talk to somebody, because we are as sick as our secrets. And then it can take me years to get ready to have these defects of character removed, because I like them. Some of them I really like them. They're kind of fun. Until they don't work anymore. And then you never saw anybody take the seventh step as fast as I can. You know, remove it, get rid of it. I'm ready. I'm through with it. And then we make a list of the people we've harmed, and then we get into number 9 and we make some amends, and that's when we get those promises. Remember the promises? Page 83 and 84, we get the promises. A new happiness. The ability to go through problems and handle things that baffled us in the past. Number 10 is Martha Stewart. That's keep everything clean. Don't let it gather up again. Get rid of it. And I've learned over the years, if there's a terrible problem, if I will do each day the part I can do to resolve that, then I can go to sleep in peace. I can't procrastinate because it's going to eat me up. So I just keep at it and keep at it until the thing gets resolved. And then in 11, we expand that higher power, that personal higher power. And I'm going to tell you, trouble and a little sickness will do that, baby. You'll never be the same again. And you all know that. When you've gone through your toughest times is when the 11th step was working best. And then we just carry this message to other people and practice these principles in all our affairs. And I used to say when I was newly sober, what affairs? Anyway, life has changed, and it is so much better than it used to be. And it's because of people like this that we get to listen to. And I'd like to call Don B. from Illinois.
The wrong one.
Oh. I want to make it the other way. I made a mistake. No, you're going to stay. Okay, babe.
Sit down.
Okay.
God has things under control. It's we that lost it up. My name's Don Bennett. I'm an alcoholic. Thanks to the grace of God and the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, I haven't found it necessary to take a drink since February 9th, 1981. For that, I'm extremely grateful. I'd like to thank Rick and his committee or anyone else who had anything to do with inviting me here. But I was coming anyway. You know how I know? My cousin called me in January. She's sitting right over here. She's not an AA member. Probably hasn't been to many AA meetings. But she said, I know you're coming. And you're going to stay at my house. So I stayed there the first couple of days. And this is just the craziest town, isn't it? I live in Chicago. Well, near Chicago. Chicago is one of those states on what is called the government rectangular survey system. Everything is right and left, north and south, east and west. You go a mile, there's another road. Down here, don't do that. I learned that in Akron. I went to Akron one time, and I'm going down 77 from Cleveland to Akron. And I said, I can get off here and get gas and get back on. Forget it. Oh, God. Well, listen, I'm here to supposed to talk about... something about a higher power, and I got to tell you something else. I don't know. The ones in the back probably can't see these little pens I got up here. I've got three little pens and a little gold camel. Guy from Arizona sent me these a while back, and he said, "Do you have that book, Courage to Change?" I said, "Yes, I do." And it's actually the history of Minnesota. I think it's on page 15. It says, in May of 1942, the 2218 Club, which is still a club in Minneapolis, passed out pens to their members that had 1 year. They passed out pens for 30, 60, 90, 6 months, and 1 year. I think they had nine members that had 1 year in 1942. Well, these are those little pens. They were about 5 years ahead of New York with their poker chips. So these are the very first pens that were passed out in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I told Jack that I would wear them here at this conference. And the little gold camel is actually solid gold, and that was also first in Minneapolis. So that's probably more than you wanted to know. But listen, I bet you I'm the only one at this conference that's got those pens. And that's what it's all about, you know what I mean? Lord have mercy. I grew up out in Indiana, in northern Indiana, and, you know, I really didn't know much. When I moved up to Chicago, I found out a whole lot of things. I didn't know that we had, I knew who the Dachinskys were and who the Clarks and the Reeds and all that stuff. But I didn't know we had Polish people and Irish people and Scandinavian people. I just knew who these people were. You know, I knew about everyone in our township. And, you know, I've been a major thorn for a long time. But I didn't know we had different nationalities or anything like that. My grandfather died from a heart attack in about 1950, I believe. I was probably 10 or 12 years old. As far as I know, I'd never been in a church in my life. I didn't know anything about God or a higher power or anything, you know. And so after that, I got the great opportunity to attend church, you know, a Pentecostal church. And about 5 years later, I suppose, my father quit drinking. You know, my father and mother both drank. My mom quit, just cold turkey, and my dad, too. But he joined a church and was 33 years sober, I think, when he died. Never been to Alcoholics Anonymous in his life. But I was scared to death of the God that they had in that church, you know. You know, he punished you, and I was for sure going to hell. And I wasn't afraid of that. I figured if that's the way it is, that's the way it is, you know. So when I was 13 years old, I started working on a farm. And the first day there, it was about like this outside, hot, humid. We're taking the last two loads of hay, and then we stop at my cousin's house, and my uncle comes out with the appropriate number of Miller's High Life. I remember that like it was yesterday. The sweat running down off the side of that bottle, you know. How good it tasted, ice cold. Probably lemonade and iced tea would have tasted good too, because, you know, if you were outside today, you could go for a lemonade or iced tea. About an hour later, I'm thinking, man, I could sure go for another one of those beers. And that was my first drinking experience. And about 3 years later, I started drinking with the boys, and the race was on. You know, our book says the real alcoholic is always more or less insanely drunk. That was me, for sure. And 1963, August, well, I lost my driver's license when I was about 21 and 6 weeks, I just tell you a little about my drinking because, believe me, I needed a higher power. I got a job in Streeter, Illinois, about a year later, and And I was down there for a year. I was drunk for a year. I stayed in the YMCA. They picked me up at 8 o'clock, a little before 8 o'clock in the morning. We drove 8 or 10 blocks to the hospital, and we were building a new hospital. When we got off, we went directly to the bar, and I sat there until I couldn't drink anymore and went home, and the next morning we did it again. One day at a time for a year, you know. I remember one night we're celebrating something. I don't know what we're celebrating, but the guy that owned the bar came on the other side of the bar, and I think he had a drinking problem. That's why he never drank, but this one night, for some reason, he was drinking a case of, he had two cases of imported champagne from Italy. He was an Italian guy. And, you know how all of a sudden you're wide awake? I'm standing in front of my door. The key won't open my door. I can't figure out what the hell the problem is. I remember stepping back and boom, giving it one of these. And that door flies open, you know. Guy down the hall says, "Don, the hell's the matter with you? Get on your own floor." Minor inconvenience. So the next day, the manager's waiting for me. "Come here." But that's how I drank, you know, every day. I was just drunk all the time. Drunk. Sick. 1963, I'd migrated back home and was living with my parents and had my driver's license back and would stop at the golf course on the way home for more. It was a dollar. Twilight was $1. Play till dark. So we couldn't see. And one Friday night, after I get done playing golf, I go to one of the local taverns. I'm sitting there, and my cousin comes in and says, "Hey, I'm glad to see you. Come on out here. My girlfriend's got a girlfriend here." And so I have a date with this girl the next night, you know, and she could have kicked me in the ass. I would have not known who she was, you know, because I was always more or less insanely drunk. So we got married. Not right away. It took a couple of years, you know. And she was a Catholic girl from Chicago, so I was converted to Catholicism. That's the reason I told you that story. And I couldn't handle their God either, you know. So February 9th, 1981, I turned myself into Ingalls Hospital in Harvey, Illinois. And I loved it right from the start. I was there on a Monday, and on Wednesday, three guys from Alcoholics Anonymous came in. I know some of these guys know those guys, Ed Davis and two other guys. And they were thanking God for saving their life. They didn't tell me some baloney about a counselor or something like that. They were thanking God for saving their life. And they said, "You don't ever have to drink again if you don't want to." Boy, I didn't want to. I didn't know how not to. And they said, "You don't have to do this alone. To this minute, my mind thinks if I work hard enough and fast enough and long enough, I can do anything all by myself. I don't need that help or advice from anybody." I jumped on one of my good friends this morning because it seems like March 23rd, I had a stroke, and everyone wants to be my advisor now. "You should do this. You should do that. Don't do this. Don't do that. Hurry up. Slow down. Stand up. Sit down." They've never had a stroke. They've never had a stroke, but they have all the information that I need. And I'm sorry, Hugh, but I only got about 3 minutes. Well, anyway. I love Alcoholics Anonymous right from the start. My first sponsor said, "You don't need to, no one's happy to get to Alcoholics Anonymous." I was happy. You know, alcohol was killing me, and I couldn't get away from it. I love it. It says, "We can neither postpone nor evade." I couldn't stop it. I couldn't get away from it. I couldn't. I'd just be drunk one day after the other. So I started going to meetings right away, and I went to my home group, and I'd heard about this guy kissing Freddie, you know. We had a kisser. Hogs, dogs, cats, horses, men, women, children, it didn't matter. If you were around, you're going to get smooched. Freddie kissed everybody. It was, and listen, he was such a great guy. I'm not kidding you. He was such a great guy. And you never knew what he was going to say from the podium. We started a breakfast when I was a little over a year. They asked me to be a member of this breakfast committee, and Freddie was our first speaker because we knew everyone would come. We had 250 people at the first breakfast. We were expecting maybe 40 or 50, you know. When we got all done, some people never did get any food. When we got all done, they said, "Don't ever come back here." But anyway, that's what my home group was like. We had two rules. One, rule number one is, if someone is interrupting, you cannot interrupt the person that's interrupting. If someone's interrupting, wait your turn. And rule number two is, if you look up and you're the only one here, you've talked too long. Lock the door. So this meeting went to like 1 or 2 o'clock every Sunday night. I'm not kidding you. It was just really something. And many times I saw the sun come up sitting in Freddie's yard. You know, we would stay all night sometimes, till daylight. They handed me the book, Alcoholics Anonymous, when I was in the hospital. And I started reading it, and I liked it right away. I can relate to everything in that book. And you know, I think the greatest thing in that book is, in Bill's story, it says, why don't you choose your own conception of a higher power? I had my whole life, since I learned there was a God, to try to live up to someone else's concept. And you know what? I just couldn't do it. I couldn't do it. But I started praying on my knees in the bathroom in the hospital. While I was in the hospital, I started doing that. And, you know, that seemed to work. I haven't had a drink since. And like I said, I love the AA meetings. I started going everywhere. I started going to Akron to Founders Day, and if you haven't been to Founders Day, you should go. I have about 11 or 12,000 people every year. Nice little meeting. And when I got there, I met Dr. Bob's kids, Sue and Smitty, both of them. I got to be great friends with both of them, especially Sue. I'd always go to Akron. She didn't want to go to the big meeting. I didn't want to go to the big meeting. We'd go out for dinner all the time, you know. And go places and do things. One time, I used to go 3 or 4 times a year. One time I went there, I said, what do you need, Sue? You need me to do something for you? I bought her a TV, one of these ones she could take her cassette or her tapes in, play it by herself, you know. I guess African people don't know how to do that stuff. But I did it. And she gave me a book. She gave me a book called The Betty Book. And if you've read Dr. Bob and the Good Old Timers, it tells in there how they were studying spirituality. And also, there's another guy. I don't know if you ever heard of this guy or not. Ford. What was his name? Arthur Ford. Arthur Ford is the guy who he got the message about Houdini, you know. Houdini and his wife had a pact that whichever one died first, the other one would contact him. And the message came to Arthur Ford. And he planted it in the New York Times like he was told to. And she saw it and contacted him right away. He credits Bob and Bill with saving his life. He was some kind of alcoholic. I think in 1926 he was in an automobile accident in North Carolina and spent over a year in the hospital. And after about 5 years, the doctor said, we got to get you off of these painkillers. Tonight when you go to bed, I want you to have 2 shots of whiskey. He said the first night he drank a half a quart. So Bob and Bill sobered him up. And if you go to Stepping Stones, there's a book in there, at least one, signed by Arthur Ford to Bill and Lois. And he was the most famous medium ever from the United States. Betty was a medium. And her and her husband spent 19 years channeling and writing all this information down. The book I brought with me is called The Road I Know. It's the instructions for getting sober, staying sober, and developing a higher power. I'm telling you, it is the next level. It is the next level. I got interested in this right away. I wanted to try to do channeling. People channeling told me, you're too grounded. So I figured it out, you know, that's not what I'm supposed to be doing. I'm supposed to be doing something, but that's not what I'm supposed to be doing. And I know it's probably scary when people talk about this, but I'm telling you, my guides send me all kinds of information. I do all kinds of things. I play games with them. It's incredible. And my friend down here, James Lee, I don't know if you know James or not. James and I do a big book study, and I tell James all the time, God is not lost. You don't have to search for him. He's not lost. And he's never late. He's always on time. We're sitting in the best hotel in the city, right down the street here. We've had the rooms for about 2 years. We've transferred about 4 or 5 rooms this week and the past week. People that thought they were coming couldn't get out because if you book a room with me, you're not getting your money back. This is not for people that might be coming. It's for people that are coming. But James had a minor glitch the other day, and sure enough, the phone rings. After we're here, we had one room. After we're here, I need a room, Dan. God is never late, and I'm just telling you. It says in this book that says deep down inside all of us, just like it does in the big book, that we have this inner spirit, and we need to develop this inner spirit. It has been retarded through years of suppression. We suppress, you know, we get messages from God all the time, every day, every hour. And if we suppress them, then they will go deeper inside, and we have to let them come out. Just let them come out. Don't be afraid. You don't have to be afraid. You know, he's not going to cause you any trouble. He created you in his image so that you would be like him. So he is certainly not going to cause you any problems or do anything to hurt you. Why would he do that? That doesn't make any sense, does it? You know, you wouldn't go around with your children and with a ball bat and start beating on their legs and limbs and back and head and stuff, would you? So he wouldn't do that to you. I hear all the time, when I came here, this is what they said to me. When you've been with your wife as long sober as you have drinking, then you have something to say. Until then, you keep your mouth shut. I have 29 years. I drank for maybe with her from, what, 63, about 17 or something. You know what I've learned? Keep your mouth shut. I ran out of time. I thank you for letting me talk.
Our last speaker is John Kay, South Carolina.
Hey everybody, I'm John and I'm an alcoholic. I don't know how I'm going to follow up after those two stories, but I'll do whatever God wants me to do. I sat in the back of the room towards the end of the last meeting, and as the people were clearing out, I tried to pray a little bit, and I prayed, you know, God, give my feet wings and let me run out the door or come up here, one of the two, and here I am. So I guess that's what God wanted me to do. I've heard some great, great things while I've been here. I've heard some great speakers. I've heard some great things that if I can remember some of them, I'm going to pass on, and if I can't, I won't. One of the things I heard that really struck me was I have a sponsor today, and he knows he's my sponsor, because I couldn't always say that. There was a point in my sobriety where the only sponsor that knew he was my sponsor was me. I tried sponsorship early on, and I went through a couple of sponsors before I ended up with a sponsor named Bob Merritt. And Bob was one of the finest, kindest men that I ever knew, and he walked me through the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, and We started a big book study from 1996 till 2004 when Bob passed away, and I was with him and holding his hand when he passed away, and I miss him every day. And I struggled with sponsorship for a few years after that, and but I have a sponsor today that knows he's my sponsor, and his name is Bob Wiley, and he can't be here, but I did call him yesterday, and he wished me well. I called or I texted my brother this morning. My brother's in the program also in Denver, Colorado. And I said, David, about 3 o'clock this afternoon, would you pray for me? Because I got to get up here and do this. And he said, I will pray for the audience. So, so you're in good hands. I have friends here almost the entire fourth row back here are my friends from South Carolina. My home group is the Wade Hampton Group in Greenville, South Carolina. We meet on Mondays, on Tuesdays and Thursdays, Tuesdays and Fridays. Friday night has traditionally been a speaker meeting. We're about to change our format and start having 3 nights of the month, an 11-step meeting on Friday night. On Tuesdays, we have a closed discussion group, and we have Al-Anon. We have Alateen. We have the only Alateen group in Greenville, South Carolina. My daughter is a member of Alateen, Emily here. And we have a babysitter if single moms or dads or not single, you know, married folks that want to come, bring their kids. We have a babysitter. And we have a cat. So we have Alacat if you need. So far the cat's been the only attendee at the Alacat meeting, but if you have a cat that's got a problem with alcohol, bring it to the Wade Hampton group. We don't have Ella Dog, but I think the cat would allow it. I got here for probably the same reason a lot of y'all got here. I drank a whole lot of liquor and I couldn't stop. I drank from the time I was young until I got here at age 38. Every day for the last 4 or 5 years of my drinking, I got up every morning and I said, I'm not going to do it again today. And every day I did. Every day I drove to work and said, today is going to be the day I'm going to go home and be a good husband and a good father. And every day when I left work, I said, if I can just get home, I can do this deal. You know, I can go home and eat dinner and be with my family. And I just couldn't make it. And my car would pull off in the liquor store, and I'd get a pint of scotch, and I'd ride around in my car until that was gone, and I'd throw the bottle out the window. And I'd get another one, and the next day I'd wake up not knowing whether I'd had dinner or how I got home or whether my car was in the driveway. And I'd get up and do it again. And I had a little intervention happen to me on November the 3rd of 1992. My sobriety date is November the 5th of 1992. On the November the 3rd of 1992, the Sheriff's Department decided they didn't want me driving around drunk anymore, and they took me to jail for the third time for DUI. I came out of a blackout in the drunk tank of the Greenville County Detention Center. And for the third time, I had to call my wife and ask her to come get me out of jail for DUI. And she said, but I figured that she wasn't going to get me out if I didn't have a good story. So I made up this story that I was ready to go to treatment. And it worked. And she came and got me out of jail. When she picked me up the next morning on November the 4th, it was a Thursday morning, she said, John, I got some bad news. I can't get you into Charter Hospital. And I thought, man, I've got away with it one more time, you know. She said, but we have a bed for you in Wellspring over in Williamston, South Carolina, tomorrow, and you'll be going there first thing Friday morning. So she took me home. We got my car out of the compound and took it home and parked it, and she took the keys and left me at home, and she went back to work. And I didn't know what to do. I really, really didn't know what to do. And I went to my car, and I took the bottle of Listerine out of the glove compartment because I drank Listerine because you could buy it on Sundays in South Carolina. And it has the same amount of alcohol in it as good scotch, and it tastes a little bit better than most of the scotch that I drank. And I took the bottle of Listerine out of the glove box of the car that I had, and I looked at it, and I thought about drinking it, and I took the cap off of it, and I poured it out. And that was my last. I haven't had a drink since that day. On the next day, on a Friday, November the 5th, I went to a treatment center. And I didn't go because I wanted to stop drinking. I didn't go because I had any desire to get sober or meet you people or be here. I went because I didn't have any choice. I wasn't going to be in good graces with my wife and my family, and I wasn't going to get a key to the house if I didn't. So I went. I like to tell people, if you know somebody that's in treatment for all the wrong reasons, that's great. Maybe they'll get the message while they're there. You know, I did. I caught it while I was there. I found God in that treatment center. I was there for 5 or 6 days. I don't really know. I got there on a Friday, a couple of days of detox and do nothing, and then Monday morning they started the group therapy stuff, you know. And I love treatment centers. I would not be here today if it wasn't for this treatment center, because I could not. I don't know that I could have physically separated myself from alcohol long enough to get the message. They did. They kept me locked up long enough for my head to clear up and for me to hear the message. And the message that I heard about 5 or 6 days into treatment was a guy who came in. I don't know who he was. Maybe he's here. He was from the Seneca, South Carolina area. That's all I can remember. And he shared his story. And his story was that he was a hopeless, helpless alcoholic like me, and that he'd found the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, and he'd found God, and his life had gotten better. And he'd turned his will and his life over to the care of God, and life was good today. And if I wanted that, I could have that too, if I was willing to give it up, and if I was willing to turn my will and my life over to the care of God. So after the meeting, I went back to my room, and it was the first time that I'd ever been in my room in that treatment center that my roommate was not there. He stayed there from... I mean, I'd never walked in the room that I shared with another patient. I'd never been in that room that he wasn't there, and he wasn't there that night. And I don't know if I could have done what I did had he been there, but because he wasn't there, I got down on my knees beside my bed, and I cried and I prayed, and I said, God, I cannot live like this anymore. And I don't know what to do, and please help me. And God wrapped his arms around me, and I felt his presence for the first time in my life. And the desire to drink was taken away from me, and it's not come back. And that was November the 10th or 11th of 1992. And I've never had the desire to pick up a drink since. I've had the desire to blow my brains out. I've had the desire to run my car into a bridge. I've had the desire to blow your brains out. But I haven't had the desire to pick up a drink since that day when I asked God to remove that. And I grew up in the First Presbyterian Church in a little town called Perry, Florida. And my mother was the church secretary, and my dad was a deacon, and Ed Albright was the minister. And I went every time we went, not because they made me go, but because that's what my family did. And I grew up knowing God. I knew about God. I knew all the things that they teach you in the Presbyterian Church, from Sunday school and youth ministry and youth camps and all that. I knew about God, but God had never touched me till that day. And that day, when I finally was desperate enough to kneel down and ask God to help me, God touched me. So I got out of treatment, and I went to my first meeting, and I picked up a white chip, and I asked God to be my sponsor. And Daryl L. and I started working the 12 steps. And Daryl told me right away, he said, I've not worked all the steps myself, so I can't help you with all the steps, but I'll help you to understand the disease of alcoholism, and we'll help you find another sponsor. And so that was that one of those sponsors that I had his phone number and he had mine, and that was about as far as it went. And Daryl would call me occasionally and say, John, I was just checking to see if your phone was still working. Then he'd hang up. And I didn't get the message, you know. And Daryl and I made arrangements to go to a, we were going to meet at a meeting somewhere. He said, there's a great speaker over here. You got to hear, you know, you need to hear this guy. And I said, I'll meet you there, Daryl. I didn't show up. And Daryl called me later on. He said, man, that speaker had something you needed to hear. And I said, what was it, Daryl? He said, I don't know. I said, you weren't there to hear it. I don't know what you need to hear. So Daryl was patient and loving and kind and put up with me until a fellow named Jeff came along. And Jeff, my home group was the Summit group. And it turns out Donald and I know one of the old members who's passed away of my Summit group, Don Gregg. And Don knew Don Gregg, and small world. I was at my home group one time, and a guy who had never, it was his first meeting in Greenville. His name was Jeff. He came in, and it was we split up into five different groups. And the group that I went to, there were four guys. There was me and Mike and Barry Dean and Jeff, the new guy. And Barry Dean was chairing the meeting, and he said, we're going to talk about what we're doing today to work the 12 steps, and what are we doing in recovery today. And Mike shared, and Barry Dean shared, and it got around to me, and I said, you know, I'm not doing anything. I got honest for the first time in a couple of years. I was 2.5 years sober. And I said, I'm not doing anything, and I'm miserable. I don't have a sponsor that I'm working with. I'm not doing the steps. I'm not doing anything. And so Jeff, this new guy, looked at me and said, what in the hell are you doing taking up a seat in Alcoholics Anonymous, you know? Said, if you're not going to work the 12 steps and get sober, I'll take you to the liquor store after the meeting and buy you your first drink. Kind of pissed me off. He said, or you can be at my house. This is on a Monday night. Summit group met on Monday and Thursday. That's where I got confused earlier. He said, or you can be at my house tomorrow night, Tuesday night, at 6 o'clock, and we'll start working the 12 steps. Bring you a big book and a notebook and a pencil. And that was a better choice than getting drunk. So I showed up at Jeff's house. Jeff walked me through the 12 steps. During that time, I did a fourth and fifth step. And when I did my fifth step with Jeff, Jeff started making notes about who I owed amends to, so give me a little head start on my amends list. And all this time, I knew God. You know, I'd grown up in the Presbyterian church. I'd switched to the Episcopalian church. My wife was Episcopalian, and I became an Episcopalian when we got married, and I knew all about God, so I didn't need to worry about this higher power business. I already had that under control. You know, I just needed him to start performing miracles in my life. And I wanted God to make all this easy because I knew him, you know? I mean, I knew God, and he was supposed to take care of me. And it wasn't until I got to the ninth step amends that I started finding out about the power of God, or the power of the higher power, the power part in the higher power thing. God revealed himself several more times to me in various ways, and a lot of you maybe have had similar experiences. I was on the top of the list of my amends was my daughter, Mandy, who was at the time I had not seen in 22 years. I had abandoned her at birth, and her mother raised her, and I walked out and had nothing to do with her. And she had called when she became a teenager. She called my house a few times looking for me, and I was always drunk or in jail. She called once while I was in jail, and I pushed her away and I blew her off, and I said, "You don't really want to have anything to do with me, and I'm just not worth it." And you know, because I was afraid, I was terrified that she wanted something that I couldn't give. Or is it she wanted something that I could give? I was just terrified. And so I was sitting on my bed one night. I had tried to find her. She had moved away from the town that we grew up in, and I didn't know where she lived. And and I was sitting on my bed praying for some idea of how to make amends to her, how to find her, what to say, what to do. And the phone rang, and I answered the phone. And she said, "This is your daughter, Mandy, and I will never try to contact you again if we don't. This is the last time I'll ever try to talk to you. But I just had to try one more time. I've given up on you, but something told me to call you one more time." And she had moved from South Florida to Rock Hill, South Carolina. And she was an hour and a half away from where I was living. And she said, "I want to get to know you. Are you willing to do that?" And I said, "You wouldn't believe what I was just sitting here doing." And so God, you know, when I was humble enough to ask God to show me how to do what I knew I needed to do, God showed me how to do it. You know, we've since reunited. One of the fears that I had, one of the things that terrified me so much about this was having to expose myself to my wife and to my two daughters, our two daughters, as the kind of fraud that I was, that would have walked out on a baby and a mother and ignored them for 20 years, and how bad that would make me look. And I was terrified of what my children would think of me if they found that out. What happened was I told my kids that they had a big sister, and they were overjoyed. Thrilled to have another sister who has two half-sisters. So now instead of Emily and Sarah having each other, they got a half-sister and two more, whatever they are, quarter-sisters or, you know, bonus pack. I don't know what you call them. And we reunited, and we went to Florida, and we met not only my daughter who came to my house, but the rest of the family. And I got the opportunity to make amends to my daughter's mother when my daughter asked me to be in her wedding, which was at her mother's house. And what happened when I made amends to her mother I tried to apologize to make amends for being, for walking away and ignoring them and doing nothing. And her mother, Renee, reminded me that those were the decisions that our parents had made for us, because at the time we were juniors in high school. And it was my parents and her parents' decision that we not get married, because we wanted us both to have a chance, and getting married at 15 years old probably wasn't the best thing for both of us. I couldn't remember that. I didn't remember that. So anyway, the guilt and the shame and the fear that I'd carried around over all this time was relieved, and it was a power greater than myself. It was my higher power that had done that. The higher power, the God that I thought I knew from the Presbyterian Church, had started to act in my life in ways that I didn't know was possible. I've had a ton of other experiences like that. I was in the Middle East. I got the opportunity to travel to Abu Dhabi a couple of years ago and work in the Middle East, and I was the only sober person I knew there, and it was kind of during that time I was sponsoring myself too, but people in the Middle East are serious about their religion. They pray a lot. Driving down the road when the call to prayer goes off, a taxi cab is just liable to pull over on the side of the road. The guy get out on the side of the road and roll out his prayer rug and pray. They were serious about prayer, and I noticed that, because I'm not. There was a huge difference between the way they prayed and the way they worshipped and the way I worshipped, and I started watching that. I also looked for meetings over there, and there were 4 meetings a week, and they were at the little church. If you get in a taxi in Abu Dhabi, and you tell the taxi driver, who speaks very little English, to take you to the little church, there's no road names, no nothing, there's a pretty good chance it's going to take a while to get there. And it took about 45 minutes in a taxi to get from my hotel to the little church. And it wasn't working out too well getting the meetings there. And I was getting kind of desperate. I'd been there for a couple of weeks, and I'd been to 2 meetings, and I was working a lot, and I was pretty tired and angry and frustrated, hungry, angry, lonely, and tired. I was all those things. Then in this part of the Middle East, they do drink, and they drink a lot over there. There's lots and lots of places to drink. And I was, I didn't know what to do, and I was getting frustrated, and I prayed. And I can't say that God thumped me on the head or anything like that, but I did find, I started seeking help for the problem that I was having, which was finding meetings. And I started looking on the internet, and I came across a guy's name, the name Ian. And I don't know if Ian's here or not. It's an international convention. Maybe he is. But I owe my life to Ian, because Ian had a telephone number listed, and it said call 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. And I called Ian, and Ian answered his cell phone, and Ian was in Kuwait when I called. But he answered the phone, and I told him what my situation was, and he said, well, there is one other meeting that maybe is better for you, that maybe you can get to. It meets on Friday. The holy day is Friday. The weekend is Friday and Saturday. So the work week over there is Sunday through Thursday. Friday was the first day off. And Ian said, there's a meeting at 10 o'clock on Friday morning, and it meets at the La Meridian Hotel in downtown Abu Dhabi, and maybe you can find out where that is. And I said, Ian, you're not going to believe this. I was standing on the balcony of the Beach Rotana Hotel looking at the La Meridian Hotel when he told me about this. And it was Thursday, and the meeting was at 10 o'clock on Friday morning. So that became my home group while I was in Abu Dhabi, and we met every Friday from 10 o'clock until 11:30 or 12 or whenever we got tired of meeting. During Ramadan, we met in the bar because the restaurants were all closed during Ramadan, so we had to meet in the bar, and it was great. There were people over there drinking, and there were people over here meeting, and I tried to stay over here. I did stay over here. So I guess what I hope I can share is that I don't know. You know, I just don't know what God is sometimes. I don't know what a higher power is, but I know that when I get a little bit out of self enough to get down on my knees and ask God to help me, it always happens. I had the privilege and the honor to have my mother live with us the last couple of years of her life. My father passed away about 10 years ago. My mother lived alone for 6 or 7 years, and then she she needed some help and she needed a place to live, and we asked her to come live with us, and my wife was gracious enough to allow me to bring my mother. Well, it was her idea, really. Bottom line, to bring my mother to live with us, and my mother spent a couple of years just watching us coming and going, you know, because we were always going to meetings and going to school and going to Alateen and going to back and forth. And my mother sat in her chair and she knit and watched TV. And what a blessing to have her with us and to be able to share that time with her. And last August, we went to the Wade Hampton Group on Friday night, and we had a great meeting. A lot of nights my mother would go to dinner with us. A bunch of us went to dinner on Friday nights before the meeting. Sometimes my mom would go, and this night she had decided not to go with us. And so we went and had dinner and had the meeting, came home. My mom's sitting in her chair knitting and watching the news. And when the news was over at 10:30, she got up, walked down the hall to go to bed. And she had a stroke, and 3 or 4 hours later in the hospital, she was dead. The doctors came to us, and they said, there is no recovery for what the massive stroke that she's had. And Holly and I were with her and holding her hand, and I asked God, I said, please, take her home. And he did. And she didn't suffer. And what a blessing to have spent those last couple of years with her and get her that she could live with us sober. Many, many, many years that she worried about her son. She lost one son to the disease of alcoholism. My brother Paul passed away in 1993 as a direct result of alcoholism. My brother David is 14 years younger than me, and for Christmas one year he called me up and said, guess what? I went to my first AA meeting and picked up a white chip, and that was 4 years ago. He was going to try to be here this weekend, and he couldn't be with us. But he sends his love, and he's praying for y'all. So, I have no idea what time it is or how long I've talked, and my sponsor Bob said to me one time, there's two times to shut up. One is 5 minutes to nine if it's an 8 o'clock speaker meeting, and the other is when you run out of something to say. I'm not quite there yet, but I'm almost. I just want to say some thank yous. I want to say thank you to all the people that are wearing these 2010 shirts and all the people that put together this. I had the privilege of chairing the 2008 South Carolina State Convention. And some of my friends here worked with me on the committee. I want to make it clear, I co-chaired the convention. I did not chair it. The guy that co-chaired it is in room 206 upstairs right now with me, Marshall. What an honor it was to do that, but God almighty, it was a lot of work. And we only had 700 or 800 people, 75,000 in a place like this. I cannot imagine what the folks have done. I want to thank Rick and the committee that allowed me to come here and share. I also want to let you know that I heard one of the speakers earlier say that he appreciated his sponsor asking him if it was okay to submit his name. Not the way it happened with me. I got a letter in the mail a couple of months ago saying I'd been chosen to speak at this meeting, and I asked my friend David here, I said, do you know anything about this? And he said, oh, I forgot to tell you about that. So, but I've got a step to work through that resentment. I also want to thank the Al-Anon and Alateen folks that are here and that are participating in this convention. I heard one of the speakers yesterday, last night, I don't know where it was, who said their mother was in Alcoholics Anonymous, and they were now in Alcoholics Anonymous, and their one of their children was an Alateen, and they said they have broken the chain of alcoholism in their family. And my daughter Emily is here with us today, and I am so proud of her for being involved in Alateen. Our oldest daughter Sarah grew up in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. She babysat. She was with babysitters until she was old enough to babysit. Now Emily was born in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, and she babysits at meetings and she attends Alateen, and she's one of 80 Alateen kids here. And I'm so proud that Alateen is a part of this. And I'm going to read one thing real quick, and then I'm going to get out of here. Because this meant so much to me when I got here. We can only clear the ground a bit if our testimony helps to sweep away prejudice, enables you to think honestly, encourages you to search diligently within yourself then if you wish, you can join us on the broad highway. With this attitude, you cannot fail. The consciousness of your belief is sure to come to you. Thank you.
They told me some years ago, if you are an alcoholic, your mind is out to get you. But if we work at things, life can be so much better for us. The promise is if we are painstaking about this phase of our development, we will be amazed before we are halfway through. We're going to know a new freedom and a new happiness. We will not regret the past, nor wish to shut the door on it. We will comprehend the word serenity, and we will know peace. No matter how far down the scale we have gone, we will see how our experience can benefit others, and that feeling of uselessness and self-pity will disappear. We will lose interest in selfish things and gain interest in our fellows. Self-seeking will slip away. Our whole attitude and outlook upon life will change. Fear of people and of economic insecurity these days, yes, will leave us. We will intuitively know how to handle situations which used to baffle us, and we will suddenly realize that God is doing for us what we could not do for ourselves. Are these extravagant promises? They are being fulfilled among us, sometimes quickly and sometimes slowly, but they will always materialize. You heard it. They will always materialize if we work for them. I thank you so much for being here today. I thank my speakers. I wish you a wonderful new life with your good health. And keep carrying the message as you have. Thank you so much. Let's close with the Serenity Prayer, please.